The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, League Cup, huzzah for Birmingham. City end own trophy drought, extend Arsenal's as Koscielny and Chesney prove Ashley Cole not the only careless gunner doing damage at the rear. We hear from our man at Wembley. Elsewhere, Premier League. Red Devils win v Wigan. Similarity noted between Wayne Rooney and Guy Garvey. They both produce big hits with elbow. While West Ham whip Liverpool and Wolves want Blackpool. Europe, we drool over Alexis Sanchez and that 7-0 away win. There's drama with Dortmund, Bayern Munich and the Americans Bayern Roma. Uli Hoeneß' sausage and Plymouth Argyle. Skin pilgrims versus the world. All of that in today's Football Weekly. Hello, everybody. AC and Jimbo back here in the pod. I flew back in yesterday, heard that the News of the World had a scoop about Ashley Cole making a trainee's bottom bleed. I got entirely the wrong idea. Then I found out about this air gun business. It's an easy mistake to make. In the pub with me, looking quite concerned at that, Philippe Auclair, keeping up the Irish end of things there.
Very funny.
How are you, Philippe? Yes?
Not too bad.
Good. Michael Cox.
Hello, James.
A.K.A. zonalmarking.net.
Indeed. How was your holiday, James?
It was terrific. Thank you very much. Very pleasant. Not much happened while I was away. And James Dart.
Good morning, James.
Good morning to you, James. And you listeners, if it is morning, wherever you are. First item on the agenda, League Cup final, Birmingham 2, Arsenal 1, in extraordinary circumstances. Birmingham picking up their first trophy since 1963, when JFK was still in the White House and Obafemi Martins was still only 26. Joining us now on the line is Tom Lutz, top Birmingham fan who was there. Tom.
How are you?
I'm very well, Tom. How, more to the point, are you?
Very, very well. I went for a celebratory dinner at PDI Fridays last night, which was almost as exciting as winning the Carling Cup.
You were there in Wembley, yes? What was the mood before and after among Birmingham fans?
It was actually, we were fairly confident from the start. Well, I can't speak for all 30,000 of us, but the people I was speaking to, I think just because we'd been made such underdogs and the whole build-up to the final had been about Arsenal and this is their first step towards the quadruple. Birmingham had been betrayed in a lot of the media, not The Guardian, but in other parts of the media, it's just there to make up numbers. And I think that meant that we were confident there was no pressure on us. Then obviously afterwards, it was brilliant. People stayed late in the stadium on the way down Wembley Way. They were singing Keep Right On to the End, which is Birmingham's anthem, for those that don't know it. And it was just a brilliant day.
All right, because you get to play in Europe, and more importantly, as producer Ben points out, Europe gets to play in Birmingham.
Well, yeah, exactly. We missed out on the capital of culture a few years ago to Liverpool, so this is a bit of revenge. It'll be interesting to see how Birmingham hosts the European teams, or hopefully it'll be more than one European team. St Andrews can be a very, very hostile place to come. It's somewhere that's lost its atmosphere in recent seasons, but hopefully this win and actually hosting teams in European competition will bring a bit of that atmosphere back. I mean, the FA Cup tie a few weeks back against Sheffield Wednesday, it was around 15,000 people there, which is kind of, that's back to when we were in the third tier, those kind of crowds. So hopefully this excitement will bring back some of that atmosphere and some of the crowds. But it wasn't until about 70 minutes in that the fans started to realise, actually, if we win this, we're going to be in Europe. And it's kind of a hush. They realise we might actually be in the Europa League.
Yeah, even if you're not in the Premier League.
Well, this is interesting as well. I was talking to a few people yesterday, and the general opinion was we'd rather go down and win the Carling Cup than finish 15th or 16th, lose Carling Cup, and it just be another season where we kind of just get by in the Premier League. And possibly as well, we could be going to Wembley three times this season because we're in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup, getting to the semi-finals and then the final. So it could be three times at Wembley this season as well.
Well, strange things happen. Tom, that's fantastic. Looks like you could be making your way to TGI Fridays more than once in the near future, you lucky chap. Other
American themed diner style restaurants are available. Tom, congratulations then, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, James.
Well, there you go. I mean, terrific stuff for Birmingham. Michael, I know you've written a complete analysis on your website about this. Would you care to give us a very brief, in a nutshell, analysis of what went right for Birmingham and what went wrong for Arsenal?
I think McLeish's tactics were very good. He went quite cautious from the start. Recently, they've been playing 4-4-2, but he put an extra midfielder in there. And they pressured really well. I thought Bowyer and Ferguson had excellent games in the centre, didn't give Arsenal time to settle. Early on, Arsenal's passing was uncharacteristically sloppy. And also used the wide players very narrow as well, so he really packed the centre of the pitch. Early on, they didn't have any great strategy aside from pinging it up to Zigic. But that worked very well. I think Zigic had scored two headers in his last three games. He'd also scored a header against Arsenal earlier in the season. He won the corner that led to the goal, which he scored, so that worked very well. You have to give McLeish credit because late on he took off two midfielders and he put on a winger, Beausejour, and a striker, Martins, who I don't think did anything until he scored the goal, but he did score the goal and then caused further problems late on.
Mm, certainly did, didn't he? Terrific stuff then for Birmingham. Philippe, while they celebrate utter despondency among your friends there at Arsenal.
Yes, it was pretty abysmal. It's even worse today, I can confirm it.
What, the mood?
Yeah, I think that is it has actually sunk in what happened yesterday. If I could add to Michael a remark about what happened during the game, I think that one of the key elements was a completely crazy decision by Wenger to take out the player who had been the best player on the field for me, Andrea Chavin, who's been in great form over the last few weeks, and to put on the player Marwan Chamakh, who basically has forgotten his football completely. And it suddenly is very strange. Arsenal had been a threat throughout the whole second half. Birmingham looked absolutely dead physically. I mean, Johnson had cramp. Their right back had cramp. You could see Bowyer was struggling as well. They had given so much. And then it was a signal. Suddenly, this one player, Andrea Chavin, who can create really havoc in very tight spaces, which is so important in a game against Birmingham, was taken off. And that and Van Persie going, I think that was absolutely dreadful. And you could feel, because I was actually among Birmingham City fans, and there had been a hush, yes, around the 70th minute, but I disagree with Tom. I don't think it's because they believed they could make it. I think they believed that it was going away from them. But suddenly they came back. They found a third, fourth, you know, what's the word for that? Come on, help me. The gear. Third, fourth, gear. Ah. Breath, new breath. Mm-hmm. And in the end, one thing which should be stressed is the fact that Birmingham City won fair and square, and that many people had thought that they could apply, you know, more brutal tactics, and they didn't. They played superbly. They were magnificent, I must say.
Mm. All right. Well, it's a tough period, this, for Arsenal. A lot of games coming up. Some big matches. There's a replay against Orient on Wednesday, and then they're home to Sunderland, then away at Barcelona. Boris, I'm saying, can somebody on the pod please explain how the same team that played that classic with Barcelona could play the way they did today? Because it wasn't just the stuff up between Koscielny and Chesney at the end, was it?
No, but Cesc Fabregas wasn't there.
Mm.
He could
that's
have been
the difference,
there.
Is it?
Well, that's one of the differences. The other thing as well, I felt from the beginning, from kickoff, that the Arsenal players looked almost paralysed to me. They looked a bit scared.
There was definitely a semblance of, the fear or not. There's definitely a certain pressure that I think was visible in them. And even in this last week, sort of the moment any semblance of mention of quadruple has sort of come into the equation, you could almost pretty much guarantee that sort of fate would dictate that Arsenal would contrive to find a way to lose this one. I think, I mean, as you mentioned, sort of the absence of Fabregas, the absence of Walcott and Van Persie going off. In the last couple of seasons, Arsenal season has tended to combust in a week of absolute disaster for them on several fronts in different competitions,
and not for the first time against Birmingham, by the way.
No, exactly. So you sort of hope for Arsenal fans at least that this isn't the start again. But I mean, with potentially all three of those potentially injured or sidelined for going up to the Barcelona game and other key league fixtures in the coming weeks, it's looking tough.
Mm. Well, delicate times then for the Gunners. Congratulations once again to Birmingham and to all the lucky European fans who'll be able to visit Mr. Eggs in Birmingham. Eat like a king for a pound. Of course, other cheap eateries are available. In the meantime, in the Premier League, all sorts of excitement there in the match between Man United and Wigan, 4-0 winners, although they didn't look that impressive. And should we first of all talk about Wayne Rooney and his flying elbow?
Yeah, impressive enough to win at Wigan. Wigan, sort of harried and sort of forced them. And we're in the game until sort of the final third of the game. And you sort of looking back, I mean, Rooney scored and Hernandez scored two good goals and was impressive for me.
Van der Sar is in some of the form of his life, no, isn't he?
He continues to be, to define evergreen.
Mm.
We're still talking about Wayne Rooney this morning. And it's because ultimately you just... ludicrous loss of discipline and introducing his elbow to the James McCarthy's face.
Had there been a bit of friction between them prior to that?
I wasn't certain about this. I mean, what you can sort of see from the video replays is McCarthy steps across the line of Rooney's run, and it's almost a swatting aside action that Rooney wants to take to get to the ball. Feels that he's being blocked off in trying to get to the ball, but there can be no excuse for the elbow. And for me, yeah, the decision of the referee and his subsequent action on the highlights was particularly remarkable for me. I wasn't really
Mark
sure.
Mark Clattenburg.
Yeah, his rather unique body language after giving a foul still, but nonetheless not seeing the
challenge. I thought Rooney actually ran straight towards James McCarthy to actually plant the elbow on his ear, which must be unbelievably painful. And as you say, Clattenburg didn't actually produce a card or anything, but there are some kind of bits, you know, some dust-ups on the pitch that you quite enjoy, and we'll talk about one or two of those in League 2 very shortly. But this was just really unpleasant to see. But anyway, there you go. What about the Chelsea game coming on Tuesday night? Another meeting for Vidic with Torres, of course. Should Chelsea lose... they will be as close to the bottom of the table as they are to the top.
Wow.
Wow, indeed.
Well done, you.
That's a good stat.
Not mine. One I found somewhere.
That's in terms of points.
Yes, it is on points. They're 18 points off the bottom, and if Man United beat them, they will be 18 points off the top as well. Man United don't have the best away record this season. How do you think they're going to do at Stamford Bridge?
I am. I don't know. I don't know what to think of Chelsea, I must say. It's impossible to gauge whether they're better than they have been after the game against Copenhagen because there was nobody in front of them. And you also wonder how Ancelotti is going to deploy his team. Mm-hmm. Is Drogba going to stay on the bench again? Is he going to go again for this 4-4-2 we saw against Copenhagen, which is quite narrow? Will Ferguson do what he tends to do when he plays away from home, that is, play a more conservative kind of formation, more conservative kind of game? Will Berbatov go back into favour? It's only, for me, it's a game of interrogations at the moment. Mm. And I'm going there. I'll be there tomorrow, but I'm thinking anything can happen.
Even Torres scoring?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. His movement has been very good over the last few games. I mean, his touch seems to be still very, very poor. I mean, it's obviously a player who's trying a little bit too hard, hasn't relaxed yet into this role. I'm very intrigued is to see whether Nicolas Anelka, who probably played his best game for Chelsea against Copenhagen, the first 10 minutes, he was absolutely extraordinary. That in the game against Sunderland as well, when he played just behind the front man, he's never done it in a big game, in his career at Chelsea or at Real Madrid or anywhere. He's never done it in a really, really big game. So it's a big chance for him because he should be preferred to Drogba logically.
With Torres,
yeah.
I'd be surprised if Ancelotti didn't go for Torres and Anelka. As Philippe said, Copenhagen were really disappointing last week. But I thought those two played pretty well together. They combined, Anelka scored two goals. Torres didn't have that sharpness in front of goal, but he was still having shots. I think he had 5 or 6 attempts on goal. So I thought I'd be surprised if Drogba comes back into that.
Right. I just wanted to say that you were talking about Torres' shots and he hasn't been on target yet. But Ashley Cole. Ashley Cole. Extraordinary story. Broken in the News of the World on Sunday that he shot accidentally, because he didn't realise the air gun was loaded, a trainee's bottom with a cap from an air pistol. Not his air pistol. Yeah. And there's been a lot of outrage about this. James Dart.
Don't we all shoot people accidentally? Yes. It's you can't brush this under the carpet in terms of not a serious story. This is far more serious, I think, than almost it was played yesterday. Mm. And now sort of the police are potentially getting involved today, and rightly so. And I mean, this is a spectacularly ludicrous story. I was in a meeting this morning and said the words Ashley Cole gun follow-up. These are just not words you would put together. It's just in English football, in American sport, I mean, the American sports stars and gun incidents, they tend to go hand in hand.
Maradona?
Over here, you do have instances in football. I mean, this is not unique. There are instances of footballers and guns. You've got Maradona, Asprey machine gun, a security checkpoint in Colombia. Yeah. Darren Bent got a formal
caution.
Did he
not shoot up a bus as well?
I don't know
Ashley
about
Cole.
That.
I think
no.
he did, yeah.
Ashley Cole.
Oh, sorry, Asprilla.
Asprilla.
Lawyers. Sorry, I meant Asprilla.
Darren Bent received a formal caution regarding an air gun incident. John Oster, when at Sunderland, shot a reserve team player, a friend, during horseplay and ended his career, unfortunately. And
you never see horses doing things like
you don't,
that.
You don't. And then there was a Colombian player called Javier Flores who shot dead a fan. Who was barracking him on the way as he left the ground after a particularly poor performance for, I believe it was an Atletico Junior team.
Right. So you're saying there's a very serious business.
Given the situation and the building pressure that you've had on Chelsea and Carlo Ancelotti in the past months, this is just the last thing you really need to be happening at this moment in time, deflecting away just an extra hassle on the team, on the squad, on Ancelotti and the club. Ashley Cole potentially stands to face a maximum jail term of 5 years, I believe, is the term you sentence you can have for this kind of thing. I'd be very surprised for him to get that kind of thing if he's found guilty and so on and so forth.
No, that's not going to happen, though, is it, James?
What surprises me the most is that anybody could come with a gun within Cobham, which is Fort Knox, as a training ground. Well, you're almost frisked when you go there for a press conference or something.
To check if you got the 10 grand or whatever.
Footballers have plenty of time on their hands. Yeah. But my goodness. I mean, this is just
when they're at work. Maybe they should concentrate on the work.
Possibly, given that their work results aren't exactly that positive at the moment, there are probably things he could be spending time on, such as penalties, etc.
I don't remember any gun-related incidents when Ray Wilkins was there. He wouldn't have had any of it, would he?
Now, Wigan's defeat at the hands of United and other bodily parts means they go bottom of the table. West Ham move up to just goal difference away from safety. This is extraordinary. And what a win for the Hammers against Liverpool. A great stat about Steven Gerrard giving the ball away more than any other Liverpool player this season. Have you seen this?
No.
All right. He gave the ball away more in that game than any Liverpool player has done throughout this season.
David N'Gog in there.
I include all of them. Was it all his fault? Was it the new look West Ham with Hitzlsperger and Demba Ba?
I thought Hitzlsperger was a really good addition in the centre of the pitch. Him and Parker worked really well. They had a left-right balance in terms of their stronger foot, took it in turns to go forward. And I thought Parker's goal was fantastic. I thought that was an incredible technical goal. I think that's one of the goals of the season, to hit it like that. He shouldn't even have really been hitting it with that foot. It was almost his standing foot that he flicked it as he was just coming up. And then to get the curl with the outside of the foot on the half volley, there's a tremendous angle behind the goal. And it doesn't even look as if the spin can take it into the goal. Like, almost even better than the Roberto Carlos effort, because that was looping massively, but it was clearly coming the right way. Parker's just seemed to deflect off the post and fall in perfectly. I thought it was brilliant.
It was a delicious goal. And it wasn't just the finish. It was the build-up when you watch the replays. And the build-up, that there's a good half dozen, seven or eight passes before that in the setting up for it. But like you say, it's rare that you see a goal sort of that softly scored from that kind of range. And it was just perfected to watch, unless you're a Liverpool fan, of course. But it was almost that it was so slow that it almost forced Rayner into slightly mistimed dive in outstretched hand. But even then, he still couldn't get it. It was fantastic.
And the second goal was really good as well. The header into the top corner was just literally unstoppable. There's no way Rayner could have been standing there.
Well, you could have done something about the third one, though.
He could, yeah. That is fair.
All right. What about West Ham then? What's your verdict, Dr. Dart?
They can definitely stay up. I think with Scott Parker in the middle of the field, he has been their player of the season. And as Michael mentioned, I think Hitzlsperger, they could have done with him much earlier, after he arrived at the club in the first place. And if they can just get a little bit of run of form, I think that's been the big issue for them, is turning in the odd good performance here or there and not following it up. If they can do that in the next couple of games before the United game, got a real chance.
Right, they have to as well, because all the other teams seem to be notching up. For example, Wolves with that impressive victory over Blackpool.
Yeah, they were fantastic. Wolves only saw the highlights of that game, but they looked very good. And again, it was a manager being brave and it paying off, because at 1-0 up, and a man up, we should say, McCarthy took off the right-back Zubar and put on Sylvain Ebanks-Blake, a forward who went on to score two goals. But I think the battle at the bottom of the Premier League this season, the quality is very, very high. All the teams on their day can put in great performances. This weekend we had West Ham and Wolves. West Brom earlier in the season were very good. Wigan, maybe not as good on their day, but they have been picking up results. And I think whoever finishes bottom this season, whichever one of those teams, and there's a few others involved, I think whoever finishes bottom will be better than Burnley and Hull and Portsmouth all were last season. I think it's great for the Premier League.
Mm. Well, some big games coming up. West Brom on Monday night will be travelling to Stoke, which will be an interesting game. As I mentioned, West Ham also have Stoke coming up at Upton Park. And Wolves will be hosting Spurs later in the week, which they'll use as a tribute to Dean Richards, the former Wolves and Spurs player who news of his death came out on Saturday.
Yes.
James Dart. Plymouth Argyle, what's the latest?
It's not a very attractive story.
Well, you got a win at the weekend.
They won, yes. They're now only 3 points adrift at the bottom of the table after their 10-point deduction.
Is it three or five?
Points off the bottom, 5 points off safety.
Oh, right, sorry.
But the games in hand for most of the other teams around them isn't looking too positive. Yes, they beat Colchester 2-1 with 10 men for the end of the game.
This really ended a run of rotten results, because you sold off all the best players some time ago.
It's been a pretty miserable few months down there. 9 defeats out of 10 before then, and pretty much, I'd say 85 to 90% of the most saleable assets at the club were sort of cherry picked off at far vastly reduced prices in the January transfer window in order to try and meet owed tax debts.
Which there are many, because the money's all been kind of compartmentalised in so many different companies.
Yeah, it's a result of spectacular mismanagement from down the years, and it's a terribly sad state of affairs for the fans. I would say for the club, I mean, you are where you are. You deserve to be punished, and they deserve to be punished for the financial mismanagement. It's horrible for fans to have to deal with that. But why shouldn't they be punished for such gross shambolic mismanagement? They should hopefully make it to the end of the season. But beyond that, I mean, there's still a real fear that they could be the first English club since Maidstone in 1992 to hit the wall. And I mean, the debts are vast. There's still 9,000 came in at the weekend for the bottom team, which is a very good attendance, I mean, compared to some of the ones you will get in League One, but still is vastly down on what they will have budgeted for from previous seasons. I mean, the budgets for season tickets were far, far greater when they were in the Championship. And now, that in all likelihood, if they're lucky, they're going to be in League Two with a squad. Most of the players are out of contract in the summer, so they're going to be down to the YTS. Yeah, I mean, if they're fortunate enough to still be in existence come next season, they're going to be fighting potentially relegation into the conference at this rate, very possibly. But ultimately, if they're going to survive, they're going to have to screw their creditors, and no one likes to see that, and no club should be proud of that.
Right. Okay. On a lighter note, there was a 21-man brawl between Wickham and Macclesfield.
On a lighter note, yes. Yeah, I'm going to show gross hypocrisy here for condemning Wayne Rooney and gunning at training grounds, but for the rather amusing 21-man brawl. At Macclesfield versus Wickham, although one player obviously didn't have the balls to get involved, I guess. I've got a feeling it might have been, was it the Wickham goalkeeper?
I thought he was the one who got fouled in the first place, wasn't it?
Well,
was he still being treated on the touchline?
Well, I didn't see him get up. I thought he went down and was rolling around holding his knee.
Right.
Maybe he got involved again, I don't know. But a steward was helping out from the sidelines.
It was the steward who was holding back the tide against the hoarding on the side of the pitch. Was quite impressive. But yeah, it will go down as the Battle of Moss Rose. It has quite a nice sort of name ring to it, much like the Battle of Saltergate with Chesterfield and Plymouth from many years back, where many players were sent off in a similar instance. But yeah, the Battle of Moss Rose has better of a ring to it than, say, the Battle of the Emirates or something like that. But
it was a rookie ref as well.
He sent off three. I think the Wickham player looked a bit harshly treated by it to get himself sent off. But yeah, so you had that, and you had also fun and games on the Port Vale bus.
Yeah, what happened on the Port Vale bus?
An alleged contretemps between the assistant Jeff Horsfield and the manager Jim Gannon. You wouldn't pick on Jeff Horsfield, the former bricklayer, unless you were very confident in your own...
Or had an air gun.
Or if you had an air gun. Right. Or a 21-man brawl on your side to go with it. But either way... Yeah.
So the assistant manager and the manager had an alleged altercation on the bus to the extent that one of them got off a happy eater on the motorway or something
like that, at a service station, yeah. But
we used to get, when we misbehaved as children, we used to get put out of the car and made to walk. And this is clearly the same kind of disciplinary process.
I like that. But either way, they ended up coming back in a happier bus because they won 1-2-1 at Aldershot.
I thought you were going to say because he went to a happy eater.
Other roadside eateries are
actually there. I don't even know if happy eaters still exist, depressingly. I've got a sad feeling that they don't. It has been a soulless sort of
Simply food
on the side of a motorway.
Are we trying to product placement today, so to name as many cheap eating out places as possible?
Yeah.
Actually, yes, we haven't finished with that, have we?
No, we haven't, actually. We haven't. Yeah, good point, actually. Fans of processed meat products are going to be delighted by some of the revelations in store later on. Philippe, loads of people asking questions about France and Ligue 1. My question is, do you like Ligue 1?
I do like Ligue 1.
Yeah.
I'm like many people who like Ligue 1, I'm really disappointed with what I see weekend after weekend.
What about
not with the suspense, though. There's loads of suspense. We still don't know. Well, we all know Marseille are going to be champions in the end.
Really?
I think they are, yes.
Because at the moment, it's Lille on top by goal difference, just ahead of Stade Rennais. And Bingo the Dog really wants you to talk about the not-so-mentioned Stade Rennais. They could be on the verge of something extraordinary.
That's very, very surprising, I must say. Because if you look at the team, you would really struggle to recognise one single player. They've lost quite a few over the years. I mean, yes, there's still François Mvila. But the thing is, it's mostly the work of Frédéric Antonetti, who is not really the most glamorous or sexiest of French managers, but he's put together a very, very strong squad, defensively speaking. They've got the best defence in Ligue 1. I think they've four wins on the trot for Rennes? They're coming into form at the right time. And you compare with Lille, who've only had 5 points in the last four games and seem to struggle. I mean, they actually were very disappointed with this draw against Lyon. They thought they could use the hangover of the Champions League. Maybe Lyon were tired and so forth. But no, they couldn't exploit that. But Marseille still remain my favourites. I mean, they're unbeaten since the 4th of December. And they keep winning games 1-0, 2-1. But they do it all the time.
Right.
And it was, again, André Ayew, who was the star of the show for OM. And I want to say a word about André Ayew. I was talking to Mr. Cox here before the show, and I was saying that it must be the most dense football family in the history of the game. You know who is his dad?
Pelé.
Abedi Pelé. Mm. Now, do you know that his uncle also played professional football? And that was in Portugal, played for Boavista. Kwame Ayew is the brother of Ibrahim Ayew, who plays for Zamalek, and the brother of Jordan Ayew, who plays also for Marseille. He's considered one of the brightest hopes of the club. So that's five in the direct family. That's in two generations.
That's extraordinary. I was going to go with the Lampard...
That's better than the Lampard Red Knapp connection. It's more direct, you know, five players.
Right.
The Sodgies.
That
would be sort of a lower end... lower rent English comparison, I would say.
Right. Philippe, lots of people wanting to know what Eden Hazard's going to do. I should also mention Bingo the Dog, this attracted my interest. The Stade Rennais not spending any money. They're owned by the fourth richest man in France.
Pino Valenciennes, yes.
Yeah.
But he spent some money in the past. not people remember that Luis Fabiano was a Stade Rennais player.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, he was. And he was rubbish when he was there.
Where's the money from? Where does François Pinault get his money from?
It's one of those huge multinational groups which do everything from champagne to cars and probably weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
You know, everything.
Excellent.
He's decided... to stop actually spending money about a season and a half ago. At the time, actually, the chairman was a friend of mine, Frédéric de Saint-Cernin, and it was very clear that they would have to deliver. They thought they could become one of the big clubs in France. They invested, and it didn't quite work out as they planned. And then Monsieur Pino Valenciennes has decided. He's done an Abramovich French style. So is he going to do an Abramovich Mark II and put money again? I don't know.
Okay. Do you know, in a word, where Eden Hazard's going?
No, I have no idea of where Eden Hazard is going.
I'm not going to ask you if you're going to hazard a guess.
That's going to be yet again the problem that we have with all the clubs that do well in France, that the first season with Lille that we've had season after season, doesn't matter. And even the coach might go Rudy Garcia.
Oh.
Yeah, and there's quite a few clubs who are very, very interested in him.
All right.
Included
then.
In England.
All right. Michael, among the many delights on zonalmarking.net is a complete tactical breakdown of the Bayern Munich Borussia Dortmund game. How big a result was that?
That was huge. Yeah, Dortmund went to Bayern, won 3-1. They were the better side throughout. They are now 12 points clear of Leverkusen and 16 points clear of Bayern Munich, which is a huge lead. But yeah, they were fantastic. The interesting tactical point was how deep Schweinsteiger played, and he had a shocking game. The worst game I've seen him play for a very long time.
Because he was playing deep or what?
Partly because of that, and partly because Dortmund were putting him under so much pressure. They closed him down straight away whenever he got the ball early on, and he gave the ball away for the first goal and never really recovered for that.
But isn't that because he plays now Müller as basically the most... the most attacking midfielder. So therefore, Luis Gustavo and Schweinsteiger have got to do some covering.
He was even deeper than that. A lot of the time, he looked like a centre-back. Honestly, he was often a third centre-back. There was, I think, the sixth minute he got caught under a cross and was made a poor header. Later on, he was diving in the way. He was blocking the ball with his face. It was very strange.
That might have to do with the fact that some of the Bayern defence is a little bit dubious, maybe.
Yeah,
I mean, the form of some of the players hasn't been great.
It's far from established, but Schweinsteiger wasn't really helping. But it's we're getting to the stage now where we're getting kind of decisive results in Europe. I think that was a decisive result. I think we'll look back at the Bundesliga and say that was probably the biggest win. Greece last week as well, Olympiakos had a 2-1 win over Panathinaikos, which was very controversial and takes them 10 points clear.
Right, we discussed that in last week's pod, of course. Yeah. Sausages,
first,
Philippe Auclair.
But first victory of Borussia at Bayern since 1991.
Really?
Yeah.
What about the sausages?
Sausages.
Now, you had lunch with Uli Hoeneß and Raphael Honigstein.
Thanks to Monsieur Honigstein.
Right, okay. Did you have sausage? Was that what the...
No, we had sausages before that when we went to Bayern training ground and the canteen, they served those little Nürnberg Wurst.
All right, okay.
And of which some guys were taking massive plates of them.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. But the reason this all comes up is Uli Hoeneß, apart from being, football legend, etc., and what is he, general manager of Bayern?
Is the chairman of the advisory committee, which means is the top guy.
Top guy, okay.
Yeah.
He also is the number one sausage man.
He has one of the most prosperous meat processing companies.
How? How did that come about?
Well, it happened when he played in Nuremberg.
Right.
His last season of professionalism, when he was only 28 years old, by the way. And he's the son of a butcher.
Right.
And he was quite friendly with a friend of his who asked him to, let's say, facilitate a deal with a large hypermarket chain,
right.
And it didn't happen, but he kept the thought, maybe there is something there. Maybe I could, give sausages to the Aldis and Lidls and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he contacted another friend and they decided to create this company, literally off the cuff. He managed to have a meeting with the head of Aldi, I think. At the time, he had no factory, nothing. But he said to the guy, if you want these Nuremberg sausages, which are very tasty, and you say yes, we'll build the factory. And the guys were completely flabbergasted, saying, well, we don't have a factory. Yeah, but if you want it, we'll do it. And he did it. And that was about 15 years ago.
Right.
And now he's one of the king of the sausage makers in Germany. He has got a deal with McDonald's.
Right.
Where you can order a magnificent McWurst or whatever it's called.
So if you want the Wurst burgers, you go to McDonald's, is that?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Ka-ching.
That's amazing, isn't it? And yet he still has... maybe he should be concentrating on the football club. Maybe.
Yeah, it's not doing well enough.
Not doing well enough. Mm. How fascinating, Philippe. And speaking of sons of butchers... that brings us on rather nicely to Claudio Ranieri, who, of course, no longer in charge at Roma. We'll be talking about that and who is in charge and all sorts of exciting things from Serie A, like that amazing Alexis Sanchez performance this weekend that's got to have made him the number one target player in Europe for this summer's transfer market, after this. Part three. Serie A, we've got some reinforcements in for our Italian chat this week. James Horncastle, noted football journalist, joins us now on the line. James, thanks for joining us.
Not a problem.
Yeah. Right, excellent. We've dragged you away from watching Paolo Rossi doing what?
I don't exactly know what kind of a dance it was, but he's on Strictly Come Dancing, the Italian version this year.
Wow.
Alongside Christian Panucci.
No.
Yes.
That's where Christian Panucci is. Who else of a football-related background is involved?
I think it's just those two, but Paolo Rossi's first dance was strictly choreographed towards football.
Right.
They had some terrible sort of green screen background with him doing some kick-ups, and then he did some kick flicks, but... yeah, I'm not Len Goodman on this. I don't know my dancing terminology.
All right, that is a shame. And Toto Scarlatti hasn't made an appearance yet. He surely will.
Yes, the great Strictly Come Dancing hero, that is Toto Scarlatti. Yeah. Forgets those famous nights of 1990.
Indeed. Now, speaking of famous... well, actually, it wasn't a night at all, but a famous day, perhaps. The result that's got all of Europe a-buzzing has to be Udinese's trip to Palermo, the previously high-flying Palermo, and their extraordinary 7-0 win. Is it all about Alexis Sanchez, James?
Oh, I don't know about that. I think certainly he's setting pulses racing, not just in Italy, but I think even on his official Twitter page, he says, "I'm Alexis Sanchez. I'm being courted by Chelsea, Inter, Milan," which is quite hilarious. But he scored four. I think the second was perhaps the pick of the bunch. He was put through from the halfway line, and then met Salvatore Sirigu, the Palermo goalkeeper, did two step overs, beat him and scored. And it was really reminiscent of that goal that Ronaldo scored in the against Lazio in the 1998 UEFA Cup final.
I don't know what the attitude of the Palermo players was and whether they were that bothered about it. There was an interesting picture that I think you posted, James, of Mikuli's shorts. What was the story there?
Yes, he had a rather offensive slogan written across, which was "fuck off."
Right, intended for... is there any explanation for why he had that?
Well, we can only guess as to whether Zamperini had written it on there, perhaps a subliminal message for Delio Rossi. Or I was quite intrigued that it was sitting on the knee, which has caused him so much bother in the last 6 months.
Oh.
He tore his cruciate ligaments a few months ago, but at the end of last season, and has been coming back and stop-start sort of campaigns. But I don't know about you, James, but when I used to live in Rome, there was all kinds of Italians wearing T-shirts with very offensive slogans written in English, which they clearly... well, I'm sure Mickey knew what the F word meant, but I remember being in a very nice bar in Campo di Fiori, and someone had a slogan on their T-shirt, which was "Go hard, big dick." I've got a photo of this. So if you need the photo, we can post that later, because I can't believe it. Yeah.
Okay, great. We'll get our marketing department in the meantime to look at those other T-shirt possibilities. Go hard, big AC Jimbo, I'm thinking. Yeah. What else? Now, James, was that a hand in the air, or were you asking
intrigued.
To be excused?
I mean, it's intrigued as a cultural kind of thing. In case, I mean, you wouldn't see someone in this country with, like, say, Exeter City, Vaffanculo, sort of...
that would be another great T-shirt. I have to say, that would. Don't you think that would have a certain...
I'd like to see how it went down in the West Country. But yeah.
Yeah, right. I don't know whether cottage industry is the right word for this, but right. Yeah, in Italy they do certainly. They don't seem to. They seem to love wearing these T-shirts with offensive slogans written in English, which they have obviously no idea of what they are.
Right. Now, in the meantime, plenty of other things happening. Juve's collapse continues. A lot of talk that Del Neri may not even make it to the end of the season. Inter won 2-0 at Sampdoria, who also have been collapsing ever since they sold anyone who could score a goal. And they're now 2 points behind Milan, who play third place Napoli on Monday evening, which is obviously a huge game and one redolent of all those Scudetto clashes of the 80s. But I particularly want to talk about Roma, who I feel may not have been handled with the appropriate interest and respect in last week's pod, because these are momentous times in the capital, James. Nes Par.
Yes. Vincenzo Montella has been appointed as caretaker.
Vincenzo Montella.
Yes, 36-year-old Aeroplanino himself has been appointed after his only coaching experiences before this was with the Roma under-14s and under-15s.
What did he do with them, James?
Well, this is fantastic. He's been there a season and a half. In at the end of the first season, on the final day of the season, he blew the Scudetto against Milan, which in many ways makes him the perfect Roma manager. And then in the last 6 months, he's won 21 games out of 21. So his winning streak, if you like, officially came to an end on Sunday.
But he won his first game with Roma, didn't he, at Bologna?
Yes, he did. So I think it went to 22 out of 22, but now it's 22-1 and 1 drawn. So.
All right.
It
was a brave, very brave appointment in some ways. The 2-2 draw with Parma should mention that Amaury, who couldn't score for literally a year when he was at Juve, is now, I think, on his third goal for Parma, and a brilliant flying backheel in that.
I think his first goal for Parma a couple of weeks ago was another beauty. In the press conference afterwards, he was refusing to talk about Juventus. You know, they're not my problem. They're my former team. So, yeah, I don't think he sees himself going back there, despite his $4.5 million wages for scoring what fewer goals than Giorgio Chiellini in the last 18 months. So yes, but Montella's appointment is interesting because he's talked about not being a caretaker, not being sort of a bridesmaid for Carlo Ancelotti in the summer, if that does happen. That's very much speculation. Talked about being a psychologist because I think Roma have been in the lead 9 times this year, only for it to be cancelled out and either to draw or to lose. So he thinks there's a psychological problem with theirs. There's been a long-standing history of in Roma. I mean, they've been runners-up so many times in the last decade, but he seems to think that's a fitness problem, not a completely mental problem, because I think 65% of their goals this year have been conceded in the final half hour. So he's got them doing double sessions. I think under Ranieri they were only doing half an hour fitness work a day. He's doing an hour and a half.
It'll be interesting to see him try and get tough with the team, because he's a former teammate of Totti of today and all these. And Totti very much the man who runs the show there. So, James, we're just running out of time, but I just need to quickly ask you, some people posting in wanting to know more about the new ownership at Roma, if indeed they do buy the club, the American Tom De Benedetto, who's taking over the first, apart from Vicenza, curiously enough, the first really major Italian club to come under foreign ownership. And by and large, a very positive reaction from the Italian media to this.
Yeah, very much so. But I think they're getting a little bit twitchy at the moment because of Roma's lack of form. What with they lost their first leg of the Champions League second round match against Shakhtar. Champions League very much qualification for next year very much at risk. They're beginning to think, whilst they're doing their due diligence, will they reconsider their offer? Will they change their minds? But yes, on the whole, there has been a very positive reaction to Di Benedetto coming in, not least because they're looking at sort of the NESV sort of links at Liverpool. That everyone was saying, look, he's gone out and sold Torres and bought in Suarez and the like. But I think people were getting exasperated in Rome because of the number of times we've been told Roma would be sold to the likes of Naftgas, a Russian oligarch,
George
Soros, etc. So they finally think this is going to happen now. This is when Roma are really going to realise their potential. But it remains to be seen.
Oh, excellent. Many thanks then, James. We look forward to speaking to you again.
Brilliant. Ciao for now.
Nice one. James Horncastle, apparently producer Ben, suggests we might have the budget to fly in, quite literally, to near-Earth orbit one day. So there you go. Well, that there's so many other things we could sit here discussing, and yet we won't. And yet we won't. So it's many thanks to Philippe Auclair. Ooh.
I'd like to wish a happy anniversary.
Ooh.
Ryan Giggs, it will be the 20th year anniversary of his first appearance for Manchester United.
Excellent. Nice. Michael, have you got anything special for your sign-off?
No, I had a stat earlier. I didn't use that.
Ah, okay.
Which is all right.
Pressure building on James Dart.
Antonio Di Natale went to the top of the Capo Canonieri.
Because he got three, didn't he? In that
he did, and he won it last year. And so if he wins it consecutively... Do you know who was the last
Beppe
person?
Signori?
It was. Very good. 93-94.
Yeah, a little Beppe in his size 5 boots. James Dart, and thanks to you as well.
Thanks to you, James. I've got that there isn't a single game in hand in the Bundesliga. After tonight's game, there isn't a single game in hand in Serie A.
Right.
And someone might correct me if Almeria are playing Malaga tonight in La Liga. There won't be a single game in hand in La Liga either.
Right. Like Christmas in a Shaker household. Not a single... game and you'll be noticing we didn't have any Sid in today's show. We did try. We got his answering machine, and we can catch up with him on Thursday. Here comes Philippe again.
There are no games in hand in France either.
Oh, incredible. Incredible. All right, then. That really is it for today's Football Weekly. Many thanks. We're back on Thursday with Football Weekly Extra. Thanks, producer Ben, as well. So do join us for that and have a super time in the meanwhile.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.